Good afternoon. ICANN61, Monday, March 12th. How it works. Internet networking.
Good afternoon again, and welcome to How It Works on Internet Networking. We have Alain Durand from the Office of the Chief Technology Officer at ICANN presenting. Thank you for your patience, by the way. Alain?
Well, good afternoon. First off, I apologize for the delay. I was called last minute in a meeting and tried to come out as quickly as I could. Today we're going to talk about some of the fundamental technologies in the internet, naming, addressing, and routing. And a number of you may already know all about this, and you're not going to learn much more, but that might be an opportunity to ask questions. And if you have always wondered what was happening under the hood on the internet, well, hopefully we may answer some of those questions. So. There are lots of seats up front. If you'd like to move closer, please do. I would like to make this interactive, so if you have questions, please interrupt me, ask your question anytime. Don't wait to the end, okay? So, next slide. I will start by a little refresher on the OSI model. It's always interesting to talk about some of the concept around networking. Not necessarily to be bound by them, but to use them as a framework. And then we will use that to start the discussion really on naming, addressing, and routing. So next slide, please. All right. So I call this networking by number, the same as we talk about painting by numbers. You know, you have a box, it's called number 2, and you have to put yellow in there, and box number 3, you put green in there, etc. So that's what we're trying to do as a basic here. The OSI model has defined 7 layers of networking, and we are talking about the layers 0 to 9. So we are extending this to the left and extending this to the right. You will quickly understand why. So next. Let's start from the beginning. When we're talking about networking, there are two fundamental type of technologies that we are using. And they have different properties, a different set of trade-offs. So we have wired technologies, like fiber or copper, or we have wireless technologies, things like cellular, Wi-Fi, WiMAX, ZigBee, and a bunch of others. So wired technology, copper or fiber, you can get really, really fast. We have fibers now that can do 100 terabit of multiple of 100 terabit per second. Can put quite a lot of bandwidth on those things. It's interesting in cities, because you bring a fiber to a building, and if there are maybe 100 tenants in the building, then you have 100 people that can actually use the fiber. Could be quite cost effective this way. If you try to bring fiber in a rural environment, it's a lot more expensive because now you have to bring a fiber to every single house. So it's much more expensive. Also, when you try to bring a fiber somewhere, you can have it dangling on posts like telephone wires. But most of the time, you don't want to do that because it's a little bit too brittle, too fragile, and you want to have a fiber underground. So you need to dig a trench. So sometimes you need to get authorizations in order to dig a trench, and that process can take a while. So if you have already places where you have conduit and you can simply get your fiber through that conduit, it makes it much easier. For example, a number of years ago in some countries, the railway companies had all kind of conduits that were going along the tracks. And that was a perfect place to start putting fibers because you don't have to dig a trench. Wireless is the exact opposite set of trade-off. The bandwidth is limited, so depending on which technology, it's more or less, but that bandwidth is going to be shared by all the people that are local to this antenna. So, for example, if you have a 3G or 4G network, and they say that you have maybe up to 10 megabits, where it could be 10 megabit but shared by maybe 100 people. So if you have 10 megabits shared by 100 people, that's 100 kilobits per second per person, if it's shared equally. If it's not, then there might be some imbalance. And you don't know how many people are actually going to be connected to the same cell tower. This is a decision that's made by the service provider by putting how many antennas, how much spectrum have they decided to put in a specific location. So when you are a cell phone provider, a wireless provider, you have to decide how you're going to use your spectrum. Do you want to spread it a lot and have a lot of customers on the same tower, reducing the total bandwidth, or reducing the bandwidth per customer? Or do you want to put more spectrum and essentially have more bandwidth to your customers? You don't have to dig a trench, but you have to put antennas somewhere. So in some cities, like on the picture here on the right, if you put an antenna on top of a historical building, that may create problems. People don't like this type of things because they think it's ugly. And you may not get the authorization to put the antenna there. In a suburban area, that's actually a similar problem. Well, I used to live in Philadelphia, or around Philadelphia, in suburban Philadelphia, and the cell coverage was extraordinarily poor. Why? Because the resident in my neighborhood thought that those cellular antennas were ugly and did not give the authorization to put the antennas there. So there was very, very weak cellular coverage. So it was one of the wealthiest areas, and paradoxically, it was one of the places where the cell phone coverage was the worst. This is a problem that happens all the time. In some places, people have come up with some creative stories, like they disguise an antenna as a tree, and they paint it green, and they put like fake leaves and fake branches. I have seen one giant coconut tree or palm tree, I'm not quite sure which one it was, but it was like 100 meters tall. Well, there's no such thing as a 100-meter-tall palm tree. It was just an antenna, but made to look like a palm tree. So those are some of the things that people do to deal with those issues. Next slide. So let's talk a bit more about fibers. So if I set a fiber between, let's say, here and Kathy, who's going to be assisting me today, fiber is a piece of glass. So I can send light through the glass. And the light is going to follow the glass and not get out. And if I send light at one extremity, the same light will be received on the other end. So that's relatively easy. I can send things and Kathy on the other side can receive it. It's something that's point to point. There are only two people that can talk on the fiber, receiver and the sender. That's nice, but when you make the investment to put a fiber somewhere, if only two people can talk at the same time, that's not exactly cost efficient, right? So like to use it in a better way. So the way to use it is to use colors. So instead of using white light, we are going to use colors. So we're going to play a little game here. Could you please tell me what's your favorite color?
Green.
Great. Next person. Could you please tell me what's your favorite color?
Cream.
Green also.
Okay.
Cream, yes.
Cream. Okay, thank you. And what is your favorite color?
Red.
Red. Okay. What is your favorite color, Christopher?
Mauve.
Mauve. Okay, you guys have very fancy taste. So, if you want to talk to somebody, let's say to Kathy, and you two decide that you're going to use cream, that will be fine. You use green, and if you find a partner over there that agreed to use green, that's okay. If your partner receives something that is cream, they say, okay, not for me, right? Don't care. But green, yes. So it's like tuning on a radio. Like if you have a walkie-talkie and you have different channels from 1 to 10, If you choose channel 1, you choose channel 2, things are fine. Okay? If you choose a color that's a little bit too close, for example, cream, maybe a little bit yellow, a little bit red, that can create problems. So we have to make sure that there is enough difference between the wavelength to make this work. So that will essentially enable us to share the fiber among multiple parties. But the fiber still go from one point to the next. Next one. So let's assume that I would like to get a fiber from my office to here in San Juan, Puerto Rico. My office is in Washington, D.C. And I would like to have this for this ICANN meeting. I'm certainly not going to ask for a ship to lay a new fiber to come here. That's going to cost a fortune. That's going to take forever. I have to use things that already exist. But what are the odds that there's already a fiber that goes straight from my office all the way to here? None. But there might be a fiber that goes from my office to in Washington, D.C., to some kind of a central office in Washington. There might be another fiber that goes from there to a central office in Miami. And there might be a fiber that goes from Miami to a central office here in Puerto Rico, in San Juan, and another fiber that goes from that central office in San Juan to the exhibition hall here. What I'm going to do is to patch them all together and create what we call the fiber path. I'm going to stitch them. Now, you are using green. Maybe between here and the office, central office in San Juan, maybe you will be the only one using green. But most likely there will be somebody using green in between San Juan and Miami already. It's kind of a popular color. So you cannot use green all the way. But that's okay. What we are going to do is each element of the fiber path will have to agree. So when we stitch them, we may convert. So we may start from green from here to the office in San Juan, then we will convert to blue from San Juan to Miami, where we'll convert to red from Miami to Washington, and convert to purple from Washington to my office. All I need to know is that for each end of those little segments in the path, we all agree. And in the end, you will talk green, I will receive purple, and that's fine, as long as we agree on that. So one of the first things that comes here is this notion of agreement. If we all agree on how it's going to work, it's going to work. If we disagree and I put random stuff and you listen to random stuff, well, nothing will work. So that's one of the fundamental things on the internet. This entire system works because people decide to cooperate. So I was saying that you can have fiber now multiple hundreds of gigabit per second. That's our faster one. There's some smaller speed available. Typically in a data center, you will find 1 gigabit per second or 10 gigabit or 25. Now on many servers, you find 40. Very often when you have 40, it's actually 4 times 10. So there are 4 ports of 10 gigabit that are patched together to make 40. So if you want to have 400, for example, you would take 4 times 100. 2 times 100, 4 times 100 is, oh, 2 times or 4 times anything is fairly common. When you go to 5 times, 10, 6 times, 7 times, 10 times something, it becomes really hard and really, really expensive. That's why you need the next generation of technology. So when we went from 10 gig to 100 gig, the very first 100 gig were actually 10 gigs put together. But it was extraordinarily expensive until the technology caught up, and then the standard came with 400 native. Now we can take 100 native and patch it together to do 200 native or 400 native. The problem is that it takes longer and longer and longer every time we define a new generation of fiber technology. So the standardization process is pushing the physics a little bit far those days, and it's more expensive and takes longer. So next slide. So when we have all those fiber paths together, we start to build network. And when we put all the networks together, that's when we have the internet. So the internet spells with a capital I for a simple reason, is that that's a network of network. That's really what it is. It's not just one network. It's a network of networks. And why we do that is that we want to separate the networks. If I have my networks and things in my network, and you have your network, you want to receive traffic from me only for things that matters to you. If I have a lot of internal traffic, you don't want to see it. There's no reason why you should pay for the bandwidth to carry traffic that is not for you. So we want to segregate things. Says, this is mine, this is yours, only give me what's yours. So that's what IP is all about, is to making sure that your network is not the same as my network, but we can exchange traffic. So this is done at layer 3 by a protocol that's called IP. IP, in that sense, does not mean intellectual property. Okay? It means Internet Protocol. If you want to talk about intellectual property, actually the proper phrase is intellectual property rights. Right? IP just means Internet Protocol. So there are two versions of the Internet Protocol that are in use today. The one that most of you are using is called IP version 4. It was defined in the late 70s, started really in the early 80s, and is still going on. There's a maximum of 4 billion addresses on this, and the addresses are distributed by the regional internet registries to service providers. There are no more new addresses available. We have somehow distributed them all. That doesn't mean that the protocol stopped working. It means that if you're new and you need some more addresses, you need to be a little creative. Maybe get them from somebody who had many in the beginning and is not using them. There's a market for that. Or there's another protocol, IP version 6, that was defined about 20 years ago and that is starting to roll out. At this moment, the two are not compatible, so that caused some problems. So next slide. Once you have a network, you can start a communication. So we're going to play a little game. Let's say I want to send some traffic to Kathy. First, I need to make sure that she can listen to me. She can receive my traffic. And I also need to make sure that I can listen to her. And that the connection is going to be reliable. So if I only send one message to Kathy, I send one message, and that's all happens. What do I know about her being able to listen to me? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Now, if I send a message,
Ack.
She responded to me. Because she responded to me, she said Ack, that means acknowledgement, then I know that she has heard me. Okay? So I know that I can send something to her, she can hear it. Now, does she know that I can hear her? No. She doesn't. I need to respond back to her, Ack. And then she will hear that one. If she hears my Ack message, now she knows that I have actually received her acknowledgement. And now both of us know that each of us can hear the other one. This is called a TCP freeway handshake. TCP is the transport control protocol. That's a protocol that's the most used on the internet. And freeway handshake because I send my message.
Ack.
Ack. 1, 2, 3. Once you have done that, we all know that we can communicate. So now we can send data. We can send traffic. And I'm going to send traffic. Message 1.
Ack.
So I send the message. She responds. Message has been received. Message 2.
Ack.
Message 3.
Ack.
Message 4. Nothing. What does it mean? Well, it means that she has not received my message. Right? She has not responded to it. And why could it be that she has not received my message? Do you have any idea? Let's make a guess here.
Let's say packet loss.
Packet loss.
Yes.
Okay. Why do we have packet loss?
Sometimes due to the problem on the transmission path. Sometimes if the speed of sending the packet is high, more than the receiver can acknowledge, then there may be a packet loss.
Those are interesting comments. Thank you very much.
It means that connection, my name is Christina. I'm a fellow from Armenia. It means that the connection is lost at that moment.
Now, let me ask, which connection?
Internet connection.
So, when we talk about internet and IP, that's the difference between the telephony network. There's actually no connection. It's called a connectionless environment. It's datagram environment. So there might be a connection when actually I establish a circuit through my dial-up modem to the internet. That one can break, and you are totally correct. It could be a breakage of my dial-up connection. Oh, but there is no such thing as an internet, really, connection per se. So your comments are actually spot on to you have packet loss. The packet has been lost. The question is, what circumstances can create loss of packet? So in the old days, when we had like big, thick wires that were yellow, and we had connectors that were clamping onto the wires, we called them vampires, vampire connector. There were loose connections. And loose electrical connections mean sometimes things shake, things move, and there's a like, bzzz, and electricity doesn't go through, packet doesn't go through, packet is lost. Or it could be a wireless antenna sending traffic, and then there's a bird, a big bird that fly just in front of the antennas, boom, zap, and packet is dropped, okay? Those things don't really happen much these days, rarely. The number one cause of packet loss is when there is too much traffic. So there might be a router somewhere that receives a bunch of connection. Let's say you have 10,000 subscribers connected to this router. Each of them has a contract that's guaranteed, let's say, 50 megabit per second. Okay? 50 megabit per second, and you have like 100 of them. That's 500 megabit. That's 5 gigabit per second. Right? It might be that there's only a 1 gigabit per second pipe from that router to the rest of the internet. An oversubscription of 5, that's not a lot, actually. Most of the time, it's much, much higher than that. If 100 subscribers are talking at a slightly different time, that's okay. But if they're talking at the exact same time, well, I have 5 times more traffic that I can manage. So what is the router going to do? Well, it can put it in a queue, but the queue is going to fill up fairly quickly. So the best thing is actually to drop the packet. So I will have about 80% of the packet that will be dropped. And that's most likely what just happened in the connection with Kathy. So what do I do now if I know that Kathy has not received my packet?
You have to send it again.
Yes, that's exactly that. I have to send it again.
Ack.
Now she has received it. Okay? So I know that there is congestion, most likely. I know that she can actually receive my packet from time to time, but not when I was sending them like very fast. To your point, I was sending too fast. What should I do? Any idea?
No. You have to wait for her response.
Yes, I have to wait for her response, but essentially it means I have to slow down. I was too fast. So instead of saying, packet one,
ack.
Packet two,
packet
three,
ack.
I have to go slower. I'm going to say, packet one,
ack.
Packet two,
ack.
There we go. If I go slower, there's a higher likelihood that packet will go. And if I do packet five, I have to go even slower, like P-A-C-Q-E-T 6.
Ack.
Now that works. Okay? So that's called back off. And I'm usually going to back off to alpha speed. If I have to back off several times, that may be slowing quite down. And then I'm going to start going faster a little bit at a time until I find what is the maximum speed, okay? So that's an algorithm that was created by somebody called Van Jacobsen many, many, many years ago. It's called exponential backoff. and it's used all the time. That's the way people are polite on the internet. They don't simply talk, 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 talk. They will talk. If there's a collision, there is packet drops, if there is congestion, then you stop talking and you let other people talk. It's called being polite. So there's another protocol on the internet that's called UDP. That's a little bit less polite, or to be specific, it's not polite. It simply says, I send packet and I don't care if it goes through, I don't care if it's received, I don't care what people do with it. And I'm just going to send packets. It's a little bit problematic, first off, because while you can send quite a lot of traffic and there is no flow control, nobody's telling you if the packets are coming or not, if the packets are dropped. So at the application layer, people should actually do this same type of algorithm, but most of the time they don't. So it's just a lot of traffic. But there's another reason why it's problematic these days. When we established this connection with Kathy, she remembered me. So she has to keep a context about the communication we're having. If she's talking to 1,000 people at the same time, you know, she has to keep 1,000 context. If she's talking to 1,000,000 customers at the same time, she has to keep 1,000,000 context. That's a certain price. For UDP, send a packet, there will be a response. It goes through or not, doesn't matter. She's not going to remember anything. So, on one end, this is very efficient. On the other end, it's not polite, and it can be abused. There are some protocols, for example, where you send a simple question in maybe 1 or 2 bytes, and the answer is going to be a long message, maybe 1,000 bytes. Okay? Now, let's say I'm a bad guy. Put my hat, I'm a bad guy. And I want to create a DDoS attack. Let's say that I have only maybe a 10 megabit path. The maximum I could do is 10 megabit worth of damage, right? No. I can use a relay, a mirror, or some of the UDP servers. And I'm going to fake my address. I'm going to create a fake address, send the packet up there, and let's say that this is one of those servers that doesn't keep track of anything, okay, and immediately send back the same the answer. And let's say that the answer is 1,000 times bigger. Now, if I hit that thing with 10 megabit, at the end there are 10 gigabit. I multiply my attack by a factor of 1,000. This is what we are seeing today. And by today, I mean today. In the last maybe week or so, there's a new attack called Memcached. This is exactly what is happening, and the traffic is multiplied sometimes by a factor of 50,000. That's why those protocols start to have a bad reputation these days. All right, now we have done all about transport. Next one. So session, well, most of this stuff is to transport video. Video is the highest bandwidth thing that we can move on the internet. You can have like single quality video, SD video, it's like 1 or 2 megabit per second. High def video is about 20 megabit per second. 4K, maybe double that. 8K, double again. Virtual reality, maybe double again, more or less. But that's what consumes the most bandwidth. So having a session layer that explains what is the encoding of all this video is something useful. Next. Sometimes you carry your data and you need to structure the data. I apologize for the font being displayed wrong here. But you need to explain what this is about. So this is an example of a menu. So you describe your menu and things that can happen when you click on something, when you, all the actions that take place. In the good old days, it was a binary format. It was called ASN1, fairly common in the telephony networks. And then in the mid-90s, came something called SGML and a derivative of that called XML, and you may have heard about the web that actually is using that format. It was something to describe what we are going to present to you. So there will be some characters in bold, some flashing, some underline, and is it at the top of a page, bottom of a page, center, all of that. Now, the new format that the new kids are using is called JSON. And it's a lot of text, it's dictionary, it's very easy to extend. So it's much more, it's much faster to develop new application using things like that. That's why all the stuff that works now on cloud, on those platforms are using structures like this. But none of this matters. Really, honestly, none of this matters. What really matters is the next slide, please. My kids, when they come visit me, surf the web, watch YouTube, go on Facebook. That's what matters to them. If you're a service provider and you try to build a network, those are your customers. Right? The parents are paying, but those are your customers. So you have to make sure that they're happy. If they like the service, you're in business. If they don't, you're not. Very, very simple. Next slide. That's where we start to add more layers to the OSI model. I was saying if the customers are happy, meaning they keep paying you. If they don't pay you, you're not in business. If you're not in business, you're not part of the internet anymore. So sometimes you talk about free services, but there's no such thing as really a free service. Free service means somebody else is paying for it. It can be paid through advertisement. It can be paid through other people who have an interest in you watching the product. In other words, if you don't pay, it means that you are the service. And that's okay, as long as you're aware of it. But regardless of a paid service or indirectly paid service for commercial, there's somewhere some flow of money that sustains the service. So sometimes we forget about this. Next one. Layer 9 is why we are here this week. Political means how a community gets together to make decisions. What is the process? So historically, you have empires, kingdom, oligarchies, democracies. The process that we use here at ICANN is a multi-stakeholder process, where we have different people from different walk of life, different stakes in this, get together and try to discuss and come to some conclusion. So that's why we're here today. So this is the introduction, so we can go now to the meat of the tutorial. How much time do I have left? Oh, okay. Next. All right. If you forget everything that I've said so far, that's okay. There are three things I would like you to remember today, and we are going to get to the first one. Naming. This whole story started a few years ago. I was in a meeting somewhere, and I had a really, really bad toothache. It was really, really, really hurting, and I needed to take care of that because I couldn't work, couldn't do anything. So I need to find a dentist. Next slide. When I wanted to find a dentist, I went to see my friend and colleague, Kathy, and I asked her, Kathy, you've been living here before, right? So you must know a dentist. Who is your dentist?
Dr. Pina Colada.
I need to find Dr. Pina Colada. Maybe he has some beverage that I can use that will take care of my toothache. So she gave me the name of a dentist, right? So what's a name? So my favorite exercise is to go to a dictionary and look at the name that I think I know what it is, but I'm not quite sure really, and to have a precise definition. So a name is a word by which a person, an animal, a place is known, addressed, or referred to. So there are two concepts here. A person is addressed or a person is referred to. Like, Kathy, what is your dentist name? When I say that, I talk to Kathy. Okay? And then your dentist name is?
Dr. Pina Colada.
We are talking about Dr. Pina Colada. You see, in one case, it's a direct connection. On the other one, we are talking about. That's a referral. Okay, two usage. So that's the first thing I want you to remember. If I know your name, I know who you are. Okay? I know your name, I know who you are. I'm sure you can all remember that. Next slide. So we just talked about that. The name is a handle. The name is not just to have a communication, but we can talk about somebody. So we can have a conversation, for example. Okay, this Dr. Pina Colada, is he a sweet guy or is it a strong guy?
One guy.
Excuse me?
Good guy.
He's a good guy. All right. So we have a conversation about somebody, right? So, next slide. And sometimes names can be ambiguous. So when I was in school, in grade school, my name is Alan, Alain in French. I used to live in France. It was a fairly common name. My parents were not very creative, right? So sometimes there were like 2, 3, 4. One year there were 6 Alain in the same classroom. And we had one teacher. She was a little old. And she was getting sometimes a little cranky. I'm sure you can relate to that. And when she was unhappy, she would say the name of somebody, please go to the blackboard. We had blackboard at the time, not whiteboard. So she would say, Alain, go to the blackboard. And we're like 6 of us looking at each other and says, which one? And that will make her mad because nobody will go to the blackboard. She will say, Alain, go to the blackboard. And at some point she will say, oh, Alain Durand, go to the blackboard. So I will go and the other will have a sigh of relief, not me. Okay? So it's not until you actually qualify the name that you can have a unique identity. So that's very important. Next. But a name is not enough to communicate. I mean, I know that I need to find Dr. Pina Colada, but I have no clue where he is. So how will I find him? That's easy. I go back to my trusted source, Kathy. Could you find in your archive, your Rolodex, what is the address of Dr. Pina Colada?
His address is 125 Root Canal Road, D.C.
Thank you. So I need to go to Root Canal Road. Did you notice what she did? She went to her Rolodex and actually look up the name and found the address. That's exactly what we call the DNS. That's exactly the same thing. It's called name resolution. You input a key, you get a value. That's what the DNS is. Next slide. All right, so I know I need to find this doctor, Pina Colada, 125 Root Canal Road. Next slide. All right, what's an address? So, same thing. Going back to the dictionary. An address is the particulars of a place where someone lives. All right. If I know your name, I know where you are. Second thing I want you to remember. Okay? What was the first thing?
Christina.
What was the first thing I want you to remember?
The name.
If I know your name, I know who you are. Second thing is?
The address.
Yes. If I know your address?
I know where you are.
Remember those movies, I Know Where You Are? Same thing. Okay. That's not too difficult what I'm asking you tonight, okay? So, next. All right, so addresses. So this picture here is a little house in Washington where I live. I don't live in that house. But a lot of people want to live there. And it's not very big, actually. Being inside takes like 10 minutes to go for it. The address is 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Northwest, Washington, District of Columbia, 20500-003, USA. So what's the full postal address? You see there's a structure. You have to look at it from the right to the left or from the end to the beginning. And when you do that, the granularity increases. So you start wide, and then you go very specific. So USA, DC is not a state. It's a District of Columbia. That's one of the few things that are odd in the US. It's not a state by purpose. When we created the capital of the United States, they decided that not a single state should be favored. So they created this entity special for that. So Washington is the name of a city. Inside of a district, there's only one city, but that's okay. And NW is for Northwest, because there are 4 quadrants. northwest, southwest, northeast, southeast. Pennsylvania Avenue is the name of a street. 1600 is a number. You used to be able to drive through that street. Not anymore, for security reasons. So we are told. So when you have addresses, in this case, there's a geographical structure, right? It's not always the case. So in the US, we have this notion of toll-free numbers. You can dial the number, you don't have to pay. The other side pays. So when you dial those numbers, like 1-800-something, somebody is going to pick up the phone, you have no idea where. It could be in the US, could be in India, very often it is, or it could be anywhere on the planet. You have no clue by simply looking at the number where the person is. There's no geographical attachment to it. Same thing with the cell phone numbers. My cell phone number starts with 703, which is an area code for Northern Virginia, right next to Washington, where I live. But right now I'm in Puerto Rico. So looking at my phone number tells you nothing about where I am. IP addresses. If you look up an IP address, there's nothing embedded in an IP address that tells you where you are, which continent you are, which country. However, people have done some very complex, expensive, and long studies trying to reverse engineer how the addresses were allocated. And it's called geolocation. And some are paying services that can geolocate you all the way down to a block within a street. And by inputting an IP address to the system, they can do this reverse map and says, oh, you live in Washington, in the city of Herndon, in that street and in that part of the street. Some of those things are fairly accurate. Some are not. You cannot rely 100% on those. Sometimes you will find an address, you geolocate the address, and they will tell you, you're in Germany. No. The address belongs to a German provider, but that German provider has subsidiaries all over Europe, and they're using the address block one place or another. It changes every day, and you have no idea that it actually is in usage in Czechoslovakia or in Belgium. So you have to be taking this information with a little bit grain of salt. How is this used? It's used a lot by the content industry. For example, Netflix. Netflix has different agreements in different countries for distribution of movies. So if you are a US customer, you have a right to watch a set of movies. If you are a customer somewhere else, you may have a different set of rights. You have a question here, please.
Yes, Fiorella Belcio, ICANN Fellow. This actually made me think of another concept. So you speak of geolocation, but when you speak about certain services being available only in one country or rural region, then you can also end up talking about geo-blocking. Of course, this on the case of Netflix that you said, these are certain agreements, perhaps, that the online service provider has just a certain catalog with services available there. But for instance, there are some other cases, but again, now we're talking about content, so you may say ICANN doesn't have to do with this necessarily. But there are cases in which you could be a customer that tries to purchase a certain online service, and you, just because you are geolocated somewhere else, you cannot do that anymore because it was only available in another country.
This is actually fairly common. Even inside of the US, for example, there are broadcasting rights for sporting events. And if a sporting event happened, let's say, in Washington, D.C., you may have a right to watch it online anywhere in the US, but in Washington, D.C. So if they geolocate you close to where the event is, they will say no, because they want you to go to the stadium. It's a tool. How the tool is used is up to whoever is using the tool. Sometimes they use it for good, sometimes they use it for profit, sometimes they use it for other purposes. It's a tool. All those techniques can be used multiple different ways. Next. All right. So remember those six Alain, was the same thing with addresses, right? So I have these recurring jokes with my children. So they live in France, but they come to visit me in America. In Washington. And sometimes I tell them when they are here for a week, let's go and have a lunch in Paris. They start laughing. because we are not going to take the Concorde to go to Paris, because the Concorde is not flying anymore, and still it takes a couple hours. So we cannot have lunch in Paris, France. But there's a small city in Virginia that's called Paris. It's actually 20-minute drive from where I live. It's a very small village, maybe like, I don't know, 100 people living there, small restaurant, that's it. So when you say simply Paris, in France, everybody knows you mean Paris, France. But in the U.S., there are 29 cities which name is Paris. You have to be careful. So an address, the same thing. If it's not fully qualified, there may be conflict, right? So, next slide. All right. Same thing as names that we can use to talk to somebody or to talk about somebody, we can do the same thing with addresses. So I can use an address to go, well, for example, write an address on a postcard, ship a postcard, or I can talk about an address. So, Kathy, this Root Canal Road, is it in an okay neighborhood? I mean, should I be careful? Should I take a taxi to go there, or can I just walk? It's not very far.
It's in a safe neighborhood.
Can I walk there?
Yes, you can.
Thank you. So we can talk about an address. We can have a conversation. For example, for IP addresses, we can have a conversation. Has this address been used by spammers? Is this a lot of malware that is associated with this address? Is it an address that is hosting a web server? Does this address belong to a non-service provider? When was it allocated? We can have a conversation about an address. So, next. All right. But an address, that's great, but I still don't know how to go to Root Canal Road, right? So let's make a little detour. I talk about postcards, right? I was in Kathmandu last week. If I wanted to send a postcard from Kathmandu to this address, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C., USA, I can. And I'm sure the postcard will arrive there. Not sure if somebody will read it over there, but that's a different story. The postcard will arrive. What is responsible for making the postcard go from Kathmandu, Nepal, to Washington, D.C., USA?
Post office.
Which one? Which one?
Located in from where you are sending your message.
All right. So I give my postcard to the local. I put it in the mailbox. The local post office in Kathmandu takes it, and I have to send it to the U.S. How do they do that? Do you have any idea how do they do that? So you could say, okay, they put it in a plane from Kathmandu to the U.S. But there's no such thing. I have tried it. There's no direct flight from Kathmandu to the U.S., right? So you cannot put it in a plane.
I will send it to other country, from the other country to the United States.
Which country?
I don't know. The one that has a connection with the United States and has connection with my location.
Great. That's exactly what is happening. So the postcard is probably going to go to New Delhi in India. And I do know for a fact that there is a flight from New Delhi to Washington, D.C., operated by Air India. I didn't take that flight, but I know there is one. There's another way to go, which is to take a flight operated by Lufthansa to Frankfurt and then connect in Frankfurt to Washington. So the post office in New Delhi has the choice. They can send it through the plane directly to Washington, or they can send it to Frankfurt. Which one are they going to use?
With the least cost.
The one with the least cost, okay. You have another suggestion?
The cheapest one.
The cheapest one, that's the same suggestion. Another suggestion? That's my gymnastic today.
We can say either least distance or least number of transit points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the actual answer is it depends. Like many times, it depends. Well, first thing, it depends on is how much you paid. What kind of stamp did you put on your postcard? An expensive stamp or like the cheapest thing? If it is the cheapest stamp, they will do exactly what you said. Cheapest cost, right? Cheapest doesn't mean direct. It may be that there's a contract with Lufthansa that's much less expensive than the contract with Air India, and they simply ship it to Lufthansa, right? That's possible. We don't know. But if I put an expensive stamp and I said, please make it go as fast as possible, example, it's a FedEx overnight, they will make it go, regardless of cost, to the fastest one, right? So both algorithms are actually possible. So, it works. Let me give you an example. A year ago, I went to Vietnam. I went to Hanoi. And I went to a place called the Hanoi Hilton. If you know what it was a prison in Vietnam for people that had been captured during the war against Americans. And there was a very famous person called John McCain that was held in that prison for the longest time. John McCain received packages while he was in prison in Vietnam. I don't think there was an agreement between Vietnam and the US to transfer packages, right? How did it work? It worked because there was a third party who had agreements with both the US and Vietnam. It actually went for Russia. It was a Cold War, but not a hot war, right? So you could send packages to Russia, and then actually they would find their way to Vietnam. This entire thing worked because there was collaboration between the various post offices. And the second time I'm bringing this concept, this all internet thing is the same. It only works because there are collaborations. Without that, it will just collapse. So, next. Routing. How do I go to 125 Wood Canal Road? Before we go there, I ask you to remember two things, right? Number one, if I know your name.
I know who you are.
Second one, if I know your address.
I know where you are.
Now the third one. Next slide. A route. Dictionary. A route or route, depending if you're British English, is a way or course taken from getting from point A to point B. Like, it's go there, then there, then there. The directions, right? So if I have a route to you, I know where to go. That's the third thing I want you to remember today. So let's start again. If I know your name, I know who you are. If I know your address, I know where you are. If I have a route for you, I know how to get to you. Okay? Forget everything else. Forget my jokes. But remember those three things. Next. All right. Let's do a little bit of routing. So this is a network diagram. I am the source. I want to go to the destination. Okay? I'm on the left. I want to go to the right. So think of it as I'm in a new city and I have a car and I want to drive from point A to point B. Think of it in the era before the GPS, right? How do you drive from point A to point B in a new city? Well, you follow the directions. You follow the signs. You go to the intersection and there is a sign, for example, in Paris, Eiffel Tower, go to the left. Okay? And then you follow the signs until you arrive to the Eiffel Tower. Easy, right? But somebody had to put in place those signs on all those poles, at all the intersections, before you start driving. They don't just show up magically at the time you turn the key on your car. Somebody has to put those in place. So that's the same thing on the internet. We need to create those routes, and at every single intersection, we need to put post signs saying, if you want to go to this network, take the left. If you want to go to that other network, take the fiber on port number two. Okay? So that's what we are going to build. So when we talk about routing table, what it means is a series of post signs that says, to go to this network, use this interface. To go to that other network, use that other interface. That's all it is. So how do we do that? Now I'm going to need the laser pointer. That's it. Not a laser pointer? Oh, I'm disappointed. All right, I'll do with that. Anybody has a laser pointer here? No? All right. So, look at this diagram. We are going to build the path reverse from the destination back to me. So, the destination is connected to a service provider. I have a contract with a service provider. The contract says, when you get traffic from me, send it to me on this connection. Okay? So that's the job of a service provider to send the packet there. It's also the job to the service provider to tell all his friends, service providers, I have this customer. If you want to send traffic to this customer, send it to me. So that's the node, orange node, that is to the right, that's going to tell the other service provider, I know how to reach this customer. That's my customer. If you have traffic for it, send it to me. Now, if you have a second orange dot, a little bit lower, if you want to send traffic to the customers, you say, okay, I need to send it to the ISP that's just above me. But you're also going to tell your friends, your service provider friends, that you know how to get there. So that's a game of, I know somebody who knows somebody how to get there. The first guy says, I know you. Second guy says, I know somebody who knows this customer. Third guy will say, I know somebody who knows somebody who knows this customer. It's a lot of trust here, right? Remember what I said earlier. This entire thing works because of cooperation. If there were no cooperation between the service providers, it will just collapse. That's why. So, at some point, all those announcements about I know how to get there, or I know somebody who knows somebody, etc., how to get there, will reach the source. Next slide. So when all the traffic signposts have been put in place, then I can simply send my traffic. So I can turn the key on, start the engine, drive a car. Well, how do I do that? Well, I'm going to send the traffic to the router that's nearest to me that has told me I know how to get to this customer. Do I trust that person? Yes. Why? Most probably because I have a contract with that person. That's my service provider. I have a contract with me that has told me that will take care of my traffic. Okay. What are we going to do with it? We most probably don't have a connection directly with a destination, but they know somebody in the middle. Do they trust that person? Yes. Am I going to trust that person indirectly? Yes, because I have no choice. So, again, this is this collaboration. I'm sending this to somebody who claims that he knows how to get there. That person sends it to another person that also claims that it is somewhere closer to the destination. And hope by hope, this is going to arrive to the service provider that service this destination and the packet will get there. Once again, it's collaboration. There was collaboration in the previous slide to build the signpost. Now there's collaboration to move the traffic. There are two critical collaborations on the internet to make this work. Next. Next. Now we have arrived. Let me introduce you to Dr. Pina Colada. Question.
Sorry, thank you. Harry Chapman from New Zealand. Is there a mechanism for punishing players who don't collaborate or stopping them from sending directions?
There is no such thing as a network police. It works essentially because everybody believes it works. As is. If one service provider starts to go rogue, his reputation will go down the drain very quickly. And what will happen? All the other service providers will say, this guy from New Zealand is not reliable. We're not going to send any traffic there. And they all talk to each other, right? And they will simply black hole your traffic. And then you will have no connection to anybody. In that case, you will have an incentive to correct whatever problem there was to join the party again. That's how it works. Now, can this be abused? Yes. There was a very famous incident. When was it, like 5-10 years ago, in Pakistan, when you had somebody from an, I don't know exactly what was the rationale or what was the, how did it happen, but all of a sudden announced a route for YouTube in Pakistan. And it was not a YouTube site. So all the traffic regionally went to Pakistan instead of going to Google servers. It was quickly corrected because people realized that the traffic was going to the wrong place. So collaboration among service providers, they changed that. A couple hours later, the problem was fixed. It was fixed because of this collaboration, not because some kind of a police had said, you have to change it. All right, so that's the end of my talk, but that's not necessarily the end of the session. If you have questions, now is the time. Question.
A reminder, please give your name and your affiliation if you have one. Thank you.
My name is Christina Hakopian. I'm fellow of ICON 61. I'm from Armenia. So my question is, there is a services and internet which is hide your IP, which is hiding your IP. I mean, hide services. So what does it mean? How they are working?
Okay, so hiding IPs. So usually those things are called VPN, for virtual private network. And it's somehow related to the point we made earlier about geolocation, right? If I look up your IP address, then I know where you are, right? Second thing you remember from my talk today. So what people do is they want to pretend they are in another place. And what they have an agreement with somebody in that place, and they're going to send their traffic to that place, and there it will essentially bounce and apparently originate from that point. So it's as you think, can think of it as a relay. You send the traffic to a relay, and the relay sends your traffic. How do you do that? When you take your final traffic and you encapsulate it into traffic that goes to the relay. It's called a tunnel. Those techniques have been created for enterprises. So you are in the internet, and you want to be part of a corporate network. So what you do is you send the traffic to a gateway of the corporation, and it's encrypted most of the time, so nobody else can see it, and it arrives in the corporate network as if you were actually physically in the corporate network. That's another case of a technology that can be used for one use case, but the exact same technology can be used for another use case. So does it really hide your IP address? At first sight, yes. Only at first sight. Next question.
My name is Anderson Komotso. I'm a fellow from Botswana. I wanted to know whether the material you use here, even though we're addressing a technical question, it's very simple, whether it's available publicly, especially for people who would want to use it for community outreach or, you know, teaching people basically in a community about internet, whether it's available for people to use.
Thank you. Kathy, will the slide be available?
The slides are already available in the public schedule under this session description. We are also going to be adding in a few days the link to the recording as well as the transcripts.
Thank you. The slides are high-level by design because not everybody is deeply technical, but those are important topics that need to be understood by the wider community. So I've tried to up-level the message a bit. Any more question?
This is Yohani, ICANN fellow from Sri Lanka. I would like to know the options available. You said if I want to send or route something faster, in our context, we can use FedEx like that. In routing, what are the options we can use to send something faster?
That's a very good question. Thank you. On the global internet, you don't have much of an option for that. Now, your service provider can do it. For example, the most used services on the internet are from Facebook and Google, right? So some service providers have a direct agreement with Facebook and Google, where they will host a Facebook cache or a Google cache within their infrastructure. And if they are a service provider that is located in multiple countries or in a big countries in multiple cities, they will have a cache close to the customers. So that way, the fast route, the FedEx equivalent, will be for the customers to go through that cache instead of going through all the internet all the way back to California. Now, do you know it as a customer if your service provider has those caches or not? And the answer is, you kind of know. It's not advertised like this, but when you use the internet, you can see if it goes fast to go to Facebook or if it takes forever. And that's a competitive advantage. So sometimes you will have a choice between three service providers in place, and you try one, it goes slow, you try the other one, it goes fast. Maybe the one that goes fast is a little bit more expensive every month, but that's your choice then as a customer, to either go with the one that is less expensive but slower, or the one that's more expensive but faster. Next question.
Hello, my name is Shiloh Healy. I'm the Global Indigenous Ambassador from Canada. So we're within Canada and we have service providers, but First Nations communities don't have the same access to the internet. I'm just curious if there's anything in check for service providers to provide equity, like equal opportunity.
That's a difficult question. There is no network police I mentioned earlier. There's also no network government that's going to say you must deploy there. Right? Some governments within their own jurisdictions have mandated like this. For example, I know that in the state, service providers have like state-level regulations, and they have to provide service to some of those communities, or they have to provide service at a lower price point for underserved communities. That's part of a legal framework. But there's no such thing as for a global internet. Now, there are technologies that make it easier to do that than other technologies. For example, we have seen a lot of uptake on the internet when wireless technologies started to become much more attractive and financially possible. In many countries, if you look at the deployment of wireless versus wired, you will see just a few percent of wired and 90-something percent of wireless. And that has really enabled the outreach of the internet to communities that are not just in cities, because you can serve a much broader area that way. So think about the combination of those two approaches may help in some of those places.
Hi, I'm Paul Blaker from the UK government. In the International Telecommunication Union, we hear from some countries, such as Russia, for example, that there should be a right for sovereign states to know what data is being routed over networks in their territory. Is that possible? How is it possible? And what would the impact be?
It's some of it is certainly possible. The question is what the cost of thing will be. If you look at the way the internet is deployed today, it doesn't flow according to country boundaries. So if you want to enforce country boundaries, you will have to redo quite a lot. You will have to change the locations of fibers, change some connection of exchange points. That's not something that can be done instantly. Also, when things are in the cloud now, it's not always easy to know where it is. And actually, it is by design, and you could argue if it's a bug or a feature. It's certainly a feature when you think about, I am traveling. Like I mentioned, I was in Nepal last week. I want to address my content. And the fact that I can find a local cache that is somewhere maybe in India or in Japan instead of going all the way back to the US. Makes that I have faster access to my content. So that's a feature. If you are concerned about country boundaries, that might be a bug. So I will somehow relate this to the previous arguments I made about some of those technology, about geolocation, tunneling, and others. Techniques exist, and they can be used for one purpose or another. If you want to achieve a certain outcome, you may have to put more money on the table to actually go do it. Now, one question that's of interest is, does this make things more reliable, or does this make things more brittle? I would argue that the current internet is relatively reliable. If you want to change that and enforce some control points, it is unclear if it will remain as reliable. So that's one thing to watch. It may or may not. I'm trying to dance around the answer to your question, I realize, but I'm not sure I can't answer any further than that. Any other question? Yes.
Harry Chapman, New Zealand Government again. Thanks for your answer previously. We've heard a lot recently about the concept of net neutrality, and it makes sense at a conceptual level that perhaps, you know, you've got different classes of postage and you send some packages faster, which arrive at the user at a different speed. But I've also heard from more technical perspectives that in reality, internet service providers just kind of send packets and don't really know when they'll arrive, and it's all kind of random in a giant mess. So if you could comment on whether violations of net neutrality you think are technically possible, or whether it is just kind of a random process that is difficult to control and understand the outcomes of.
It's another one I have to dance around. So at one end, when you're a service provider, you have traffic to move. Your goal is to get rid of the traffic as quickly as you can. Your goal also is to give a good service to your customers. So those things could be sometimes at odds, right? How you manage your network and how you do so according to the local regulation is always an interesting challenge. Those are not really topics that ICANN really deals with directly. This is not related to ICANN's mission. So I'm afraid I would have a really hard time to go much further into this. Another question?
My name is Francis Jesus. In the next year, I'm from here for Puerto Rico. I can do the question in Spanish.
Is ICANN is going to change the new KSK? They're using the old key and the new key. They haven't rolled it over yet because they don't know if all ISPs have both keys. If they roll over to the new key, there will be some ISP who won't be able to use the system because they're using the old key. What is ICANN doing to know which ISPs have the new one and the old one, and which ones will have access to internet when the rollover takes place?
No habla español, so I cannot answer in Spanish. So there is a process that has been designed by ICANN of a timetable and a way forward that is going to be open for public consultation. And ICANN will follow whatever recommendation will come from the public consultation on this. Jaron, do you want to add something?
Thanks. My name is Jaron. I'm the Vice President for Asia, working for ICANN. So regarding your question, the short answer actually is that because the internet is rolled out in such a way that anyone who wants to set up their own network, they can. So actually, this exercise of the KSK rollover is very challenging for us because we actually do not know exactly who is running a DNSSEC resolver. So what we need help is to bring the message out to everybody. So a lot of the communications is rolled out in the regions. So for example, in the Asia region, I do a lot of work to make sure that we can reach out to ISPs and network operators to let them know about the KSK rollover and to tell them what they need to do. So our own efforts are not enough, and I think working with you and the wider community is exactly what we need, to tell the community that, can you help us spread the message, let your ISPs know in the local communities, the network communities in your country, in your region, to know about the KSK rollover, that if they have deployed DNSSEC, they need to make sure that their systems are updated. Then that way we can ensure that nobody, when the KSK rollover happens, the internet doesn't break. So that's the best answer I think we can give you. Thank you.
I'm sorry, Alan, we have reached the end of our session, so we won't be able to accept any more questions.
Well, I'm very happy to have all those questions, and especially from a lot of fellows and from somebody from Puerto Rico. I think it was really great. Thank you all for your participation, and there are three things I want you to remember. I know your name.
I know who you are.
Yeah. I know your address.
I know where you are.
And I know a route to you. I know how to reach you. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, everybody. Up next, we will have our How It Works on DNS fundamentals. This is meant as a refresher on basic DNS, and it will include what it is, how it operates, and differences between a registrar and registry. We will be starting this session in 15 minutes at 5 o'clock, and